Welcome back to Uprising. We now turn to part two of our interview with George Monbiot. He's a weekly columnist for The Guardian newspaper and has just written a new book, Heat, How to Stop the Planet from Burning. Let's talk a little bit about renewable sources of energy. You mentioned that wind turbines are the way that you're leaning, but you mentioned in your book that one of the things you learned about the way in which our electricity grids work is that they need a very stable source of energy, and that if you have surges in energy, that it can put out the power grid if you have enormous amounts of wind at one point, or, for example, if the wind even dies down. So how do you make up for that in this idea of wind turbines?
Right. The problem with electricity is that it's unlike most of the other commodities we buy, in that rather than buying them and stockpiling them and then selling them when they're required, electricity can't be cheaply stored on a large scale except in a very few limited circumstances. And that means that it has to be produced at the very moment of demand in the very quantity that the demand comes in. If you get the quantity wrong, you get voltage and frequency fluctuations, and that will crash all the country's computers. If you get it wildly wrong, it'll lead to a blackout, and blackouts are not politically feasible. If we want this program to work politically, then it's got to involve no blackouts. So you have this particular problem with these intermittent sources of power generation. For example, in the northern United States, the peak of electricity demand is going to be roughly 5 to 7 on a winter's evening, when people come home from work, they turn on the lights, they turn on the television, they turn on the power showers, and there's this huge surge of demand. Now, you can't just switch the wind on to meet that demand. You can't switch the waves on. You can't switch the sun on. In fact, the sun won't be shining at that time. And so you've got to manage that grid very, very carefully to work out how best you can introduce a maximum of renewable electricity without bringing it crashing down. And what that involves is, first of all, you build your renewable power stations, your wind farms and your solar farms, as far apart geographically as you can. And the reason for that is that if the wind stops blowing in one place, it's likely still to be blowing in another place. So you make it much more reliable by that means. It also means if you're producing solar power on one side of the country, as the sun goes down there, you can still be producing some solar power on the other side of the country. You keep your power points as far apart as you possibly can in order to make renewable power more reliable. But it also means that you have to have other forms of power generation there too.
Does this approach, does this translate into what you refer to as the energy internet, where you would have different sources of energy being produced all over the world, even by individuals?
Well, there's several different ways of looking at what the energy internet could be. The way it's normally used is people talking about having local grids, and they're generating all their electricity locally. And this is a very popular idea with environmentalists, not least because environmentalists hate electricity pylons. I hate electricity pylons. But unfortunately, it's a disaster in terms of dealing with climate change. And the reason for that is that you can rely very little on renewable sources, because, of course, if you're generating locally, you don't have that diversity of supply that I was talking about. If the wind drops in one place and you're only generating locally, you lose all your wind power. If the sun goes down, you lose all your solar power. And generally, most people live in places which aren't that windy. Chicago would be pretty good to live in if you want to generate your electricity from wind, but many places in the United States aren't. People have chosen not to live on the top of mountains. They've chosen to live in relatively sheltered places, and you don't get that much environmental energy, that much ambient energy from cities. The places where the wind blows strongest, or indeed where the sun beats down hardest, are generally deserts, they're generally mountaintops, they're generally great empty plains. They're not where people live. So we have to draw that electricity from elsewhere, and that means, unfortunately, We have to stick with the electricity pylon lines. I hate them. Everybody hates them. They're hideous. They're a real eyesore on the landscape, but I don't see any way around it, I'm sorry to say. But that being said, the more integrated the grids are, and the wider the range across which they draw their electricity, the more stable they will be. And so you can think of a much bigger electricity internet. And in Europe, I'm calling for a European supergrid where all the national grids are joined up, but also joined up under the Mediterranean Sea to the Sahara. And the Sahara is a tremendous potential source of energy, because not only is it a desert, it means there are very few clouds, you have very strong solar radiation, so you can build very effective and cheap solar farms, but it also runs from east to west. And the great thing about a desert which goes from east to west is that as the sun's going down at one end of it, it's close to rising on the other end. And the Sahara could give us about 15 hours of solid electricity generation, which could supply much of Europe.
I'm speaking with George Monbiot. We're talking about his new book, Heat, How to Stop the Planet from Burning. So talking about energy sources, let's discuss one of the most controversial sources of energy, particularly among activists and environmentalists, and that's the issue of nuclear energy. You didn't just dismiss nuclear energy as a source of energy in your book. Why?
Simply because our options are so limited. In Europe, we have rather more options than you have here, because we still have reasonable supplies of natural gas. But in North America, your supplies of natural gas are now running down. So where is your non-intermittent power going to come from? Given that, as I've said, about the maximum penetration of renewable power would be about 50%, where is the rest going to come from? And I'm sorry to say that in North America, it comes down to two very unpleasant choices, and I wouldn't really want to be in your shoes in choosing between them. One is the C word, a very nasty word, four letters beginning with C. It's coal, and the other one is nuclear power. Now, the problem with coal, we've already touched on, this vast open cast mining and landscape destruction. Even if you have carbon capture and storage, which means that it doesn't cause much climate change, it still causes an awful lot of environmental damage. The problem with nuclear power is this. It's not so much waste storage. I believe that can be done. It's been done very badly so far. It's been corrupt. I mean, what's happened at Yucca Mountain is just appalling. But it could, in principle, be done safely. The problem is nuclear proliferation. Now, Eisenhower, in his famous Atoms for Peace speech, talked of beating the nuclear sword into the nuclear plowshare. And he talked of an arrangement with other countries whereby if they promise not to develop nuclear weapons, they could have nuclear power. Well, it was just wild over-optimism and wishful thinking, because what's actually happened is that every nation since the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was signed in 1968, which has acquired or sought to acquire nuclear weapons, we're talking about Israel, India, Pakistan, North Korea, Iraq, Iran, South Africa, has done so by diverting nuclear material from their civil nuclear programs. That means that if, like me, you want to see an eventual end to nuclear weapons around the world, you also have to envisage an eventual end to nuclear power around the world.
I want to go back to the issue of the storage of nuclear waste. You said it could be done more efficiently, but at some point, will we not run out of space to store nuclear waste? And who wants to live anywhere near a nuclear waste site, no matter how hard you convince them that it's going to be safe?
Well, yes, those are two different and very interesting questions. Now, the reason why I think it can be done in theory is that I read the technical report produced by Posiva, which is the Finnish nuclear authority, which is by far the most advanced country as far as dealing with this nuclear waste issue is concerned. And it's a vast report, and they go into enormous detail, and they do seem to have considered these questions very carefully. And they found that if you burrow very deep into granite, a long, long way down, into granite which has a very low percolation rate, and then you encase nuclear waste in lead cores surrounded by copper, put it all the way down in these down these shafts, backfill with a kind of clay called bentonite. It's good for several million years. It's not going to come out. And so in principle that can be done wherever you have a deep, dry granite formation, and there are plenty of those around the world. In practice, of course, we've often seen appalling fraud and mismanagement on the part of the nuclear industry. And a classic example is Yucca Mountain, which is meant to be a dry repository, turns out to have much higher water percolation rates than the authorities let on, and it took a whistleblower to show that that was the case, that actually the water percolation rates had been forged. So you have this situation where you can do it in principle. People will use the theory of what can be obtained to cut corners and create the impression that all is well, and behind that impression all sorts of bad stuff can happen. But I see that if it's properly monitored, if the corruption of the nuclear industry is dealt with, that could be handled. Whether anybody wants to live in that area is another matter, but the question I'd ask you is, do you want to live close to a coal-burning power station either? And of course people don't, and we're going to have to make that very hard and very nasty choice, and it's not a choice I want to have to make, it's not a choice I would choose to make, but that is being thrust on us by the extraordinary demands of climate change.
Let's talk about aviation, which it looks like we're not going to be able to get around. As someone who has close family members spread out all over the globe, I have to say I was disappointed when I read your assessment that there's just nothing that can be done to get around aviation in terms of global warming. We're just going to have to take fewer flights. Why?
Yes, aviation, unlike all the other areas that I look at in the book, is subject to very strict technological constraints. There are very few ways of doing it. There are very few ways of lifting an aeroplane into the air and keeping it there so that it doesn't fall out of the sky. And when you look at what the alternatives are to flying in an aeroplane, aside from airships, which has got a lot of potential actually and could cut emissions by between 85% and 90%, but are slow and very hard to schedule to strict timetables because of headwinds and all the rest of it, if you're looking at jetliners or airliners of any kind, you find that the alternatives which have been put forward are actually even more damaging than flying in a jetliner fueled by kerosene. Hydrogen is far worse for the environment if it's used in aeroplanes than kerosene is. Biofuels are a disaster for other reasons. You're basically stuck with the current mode of aviation. You could switch from jet engines to propeller planes, and you get about a 40% saving by that means. They're quite a lot slower, but you could do that. But a 40% saving isn't nearly enough. We're talking about a 90% saving here in every sector. That's what we require. If you don't have a 90% saving in one sector, it means you're going to have a 95% saving in another sector. And that's just not going to be feasible. 90% is about the limit of what we can reach. And unfortunately, the only option here is to cut back on the number of flights we take and cut back dramatically on them. Now, this is particularly hard for people in your position because you have what I call a lot of love miles. What that means is there are an awful lot of miles between you and the people you love, and you can only redeem those love miles by travelling to see them. And the weird conclusion which this leads me to is that the planet could be destroyed by love. Now, we've known for a long time that the planet could be destroyed by hate and greed and fear. We've always been aware of that, but climate change invites this very strange morality. It tells us that there are far more moral considerations than those which we have been ready to consider up till now. It tells us that it's not enough just to carry on being friendly and nice and kind to people around us. We have radically to challenge the way that we live if we are not to be responsible for other people's deaths. And given that climate change has the potential to kill hundreds of millions of people, and given that we are the biggest polluters, We could all end up with blood on our hands by just going about what seems to be entirely innocent business. It's a massive and very perplexing moral issue because it challenges everything we have up until now considered to be morally neutral behaviour. And it's particularly challenging when it comes to this issue of love, Miles. Of course you have to see your family, but unfortunately I think you're going to have to see your family members less than you probably do today.
Maybe I can convince my parents to move here.
Well, that would be the ideal thing. But then, of course, they'd want to go back to where they've come from in order to see their relatives, and I don't know if it fixes it.
George, let's talk a little bit about some interesting controversies around the issue of global warming that we've seen in recent days on the left, someplace we might not expect to see it. A few weeks ago, the well-known writer Alexander Coburn, who's one of the editors of Counterpunch, wrote an article that I think surprised everyone, certainly I was surprised, called "From Papal Indulgences to Carbon Credits, Is Global Warming a Sin?" And in that article, he basically asserts that the human carbon footprint is of zero consequence.
It's really crazy stuff, and it's very sad, really, because I've had a great deal of respect for Alexander. An awful lot of people on the left have respect for Alexander, and he's blowing a lot of it. For the past 3 weeks, I have had a challenge issued to him to provide his references for the so-called scientific claims that he made in that article. He has not met that challenge. He has not provided his references. And I think I know why. It's because there aren't any. Now, those of us who have degrees in science know that for a claim to carry scientific weight, it has to have been published in a peer-reviewed journal. Alexander has based all his claims on a conversation he had in 2001 with a man he met on a boat. This man isn't even a climate scientist. He trained once as a meteorologist many, many years ago. He did a degree in meteorology. He is scarcely better qualified than you or I to dismiss the entire canon of climate science, but for some reason Alexander Coburn has just jumped on this and says it's not happening because this man says so. And he obviously doesn't understand anything of science. He hasn't responded to any of the critiques made of the claims that he's put out, and some very serious critiques indeed. You can read them on realclimate.org, where climate scientists have assessed what he's saying and said it's just complete nonsense. You can read my critique on znet.org, where I've been challenging Alexander to a debate and challenging him to produce his references, and he's failed to do so. And the way in which he's turned his back on the requirements that he produces his references and that he engages with his critics, but at the same time continues to say, there's not a problem, don't worry about it, suggests that he is being completely irresponsible on this issue.
And again, those websites are realclimate.org, and then you can read the initial article by Alexander Coburn and George Monbiot's response at zmag.org. Now, your book has been out in Britain and Europe. What sort of response has it received, and did you have any trouble publishing it here in the U.S.?
Well, yes, I did have big trouble publishing it in the US. Until Southend Press picked it up, we just couldn't get anyone to take it. And it's very odd, because just over the border in Canada, for example, it's been on the bestseller list for 30 weeks now. And it's just been very, very hard to get traction here. And I think that US publishers are underestimating the American people, because what I've found being here is that people are far more ready to hear this message than the publishers thought they were, and that they are much more interested in the issue of climate change than they were a year ago, and much more ready to take action and much more willing to hear what they need to do to take that action and what real action consists of. There's a perception that people in the United States are completely uninterested in their impact on the rest of the world. And of course, sure, there are still some people who are like that, but that doesn't explain the people who I meet who are very passionate about this issue indeed, and there are more and more of them coming forward every day now. I think we're on the verge of a great transformation in the United States. I think we're on the verge of seeing a very swift political change on this issue, which will put enormous pressure on your politicians.
You're very optimistic. Even in your book, you are quite optimistic about turning this whole, you know, what seems like a juggernaut toward global warming and the destruction of the planet, turning it around. What keeps you going?
Well, I suppose it's pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. What really keeps me going is seeing what people have achieved in the past on other issues. And it's often been the case that people have been faced with an absolute brick wall of public and political intransigence and indifference and yet have won through. And we can all think of many campaigns, whether it's emancipation and civil rights, for example, whether it's enfranchisement in Europe, where people didn't have the vote and no one was going to give them the vote, but it happened eventually, whether it's environmental initiatives like the Montreal Protocol stopping ozone-depleting chemicals, which seemed at first to be impossible, and then it became possible. History shows us again and again that however bleak and desperate a situation looks, it can be rescued if there's sufficient political will and effective campaigning by the people who care about it. And what we are seeing in several countries now is a remarkably swift gathering of steam behind the issue of climate change as people suddenly wake up. People talk about long processes of public education, but I don't think it's going to be a long process in this case. I think there's almost a critical mass issue going on where people, having been somnolent about it before, having really switched off, suddenly switch on to it because they already know about it. It's not that we have to go around saying to people, climate change is taking place, it's caused by fossil fuels, the fossil fuels are the things that we burn in our cars and in our homes and the rest of it. People know that stuff. They've known it for a long time, but they've shut their ears to it. They've still heard it. They can't shut it out, but they've pretended not to hear it. All it takes is for that critical mass to be reached, and suddenly people who've long known this stuff will feel themselves obliged to act. And it is up to all of us who are already switched onto it to accelerate that process as much as possible by starting up climate action networks, by starting campaigning, by being much better citizens on the issue of climate change.
George Monbiot, I want to thank you so much for spending the hour with us, and thanks for joining us.
That's my pleasure. Thanks very much, Sonali.
I've been speaking with George Monbiot this hour. He's a weekly columnist for The Guardian newspaper, and we've been discussing his book, Heat, How to Stop the Planet from Burning. And you can visit his website at monbiot.com, that's spelled monbiot.com. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, I'd like to quote from the introduction to the U.S. edition of his book, Heat, How to Stop the Planet from Burning, where George Monbiot said, quote, "The rest of the world cannot solve this problem without the United States, and the United States cannot solve it without the rest of the world. We could tear each other to pieces over what has happened in the recent past, but climate change is too important for that." That's George Monbiot from the introduction to his book, and that's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Kwan Vu is our intern. Tamika Zoghi is our engineer. Special thanks to Mick Jezrich and Michael G for helping with recording the interview with George Monbiot from WBAI New York. You can hear an audio stream of today's show after 10 a.m. on our website. Uprising's website is located through KPFK's website. Just go to kpfk.org and click on Programs in the left column. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Have a wonderful week, and thanks for listening.